What do you love about music?
To begin with, everything.
Putting on a great show is the most important thing you can do. One great rock show can change the world.
Welcome to Sound Opinions from Chicago Public Radio and American Public Media. I'm Jim DeRogatis, the pop music critic at the Chicago Sun-Times.
And I'm Greg Cutt. I write about rock and roll for the Chicago Tribune. Today on the world's only rock and roll talk show, we are going to do a dissection of a classic album from the 1970s, Stevie Wonder's Songs in the Key of Life. On its 30th anniversary, Jim, one of the greatest albums ever made. We do this periodically on Sound Opinions. We look back on a classic album, tell you why it mattered then, but more importantly, why it still matters now. Why this piece of work that was recorded 30 years ago still matters to people today.
That's the key. Plus, Greg, we have reviews of some highly anticipated new albums by Beck and the Killers. But first, as always, we have some music news.
Big news has to be the resolution of the Rhode Island nightclub fire that took place in February of 2003. This has been wending its way through the court system in the wake of that disaster ever since. We've been following it on Sound Opinions. A few months ago, we told you that the tour manager for the band Great White, Dan Buscelli, was sentenced to 4 years in prison. Tearful sentencing for the man. The pyrotechnics were set off just as Great White was taking the stage. The crowd panicked. Fire filled the club. 100 people died. Buscelli took the fall, basically, for the band in this case, and was sentenced to 4 years in prison. Now, just a few days ago, the owners of that Rhode Island nightclub were sentenced. The owner, Michael Deirdrin, sentenced to 4 years in prison. His brother, Jeffrey, received a suspended sentence. Michael apparently was on the premises at the time running the club. His brother, Jeffrey, was visiting the club under the auspices of a film crew, actually, ironically, filming a documentary, I guess, on club safety issues when this fire broke out. The survivors of the patrons who were killed in this particular incident have reacted with a sense of outrage to these sentencings, these four-year prison terms that were meted out to the tour manager and club owner, respectively, as not enough in what seemed to be a gross case of negligence.
Well, Greg, you have to keep it in perspective. I mean, the club owner and the tour manager getting 4 years, I mean, they didn't set out to cause anybody harm. Murder wasn't on the agenda. A big, stupid heavy metal show with pyrotechnics was. In that spirit, Great White apparently is going to reunite with its original members, and they're working on an album, and they're going to return to the road. This could be viewed as kind of crass and opportunistic, or it could be viewed as, what else are these guys going to do with their lives? I mean, they are Spinal Tap, you know? They're going to be playing when they're 60 because they don't know anything else to do. In fact, the lead guitarist, Mark Kendall, basically said that. He said, these people in the club were like friends to us, not just rock fans. There's a fellowship with the surviving victims. We all get together, we hug, we cry. For the majority of them, they all want to hear the band play again. May or may not be the case. I think there are probably some people who don't want to because a massive civil suit is underway against him and against the lead singer of the band. So the criminal part of this is finally done with 2 4-year sentences behind bars, but the civil thing is going to go on for a while.
All right, we got some more music news.
I got some bad news for you, sunshine. Pink isn't well. He stayed back at the hotel and they've sent us along. There's a surrogate band. We're gonna find out where you fans really stand.
That's Roger Waters with In the Flesh. He played that to open a set that he performed in Chicago the other night, Greg. You and I were there. Roger Waters, founding member of Pink Floyd, crossing the country, playing in California, I believe, tonight, and Seattle in a couple days. A 3-night stand at the Hollywood Bowl, sold out. I just wanted to say a few words about this Waters show, because I was blown away. I have to say that in the divorce, the great divorce that left David Gilmour, Nick Mason, Rick Wright as Pink Floyd, and Roger Waters out in the cold, I sided with Gilmour, because Gilmour was the masterful musician, Waters was the conceptualist. I'd rather have pretty-sounding music with no concept than a lot of concept and lousy music.
Yes.
Although I certainly respect Waters as a songwriter. But what he did was really interesting, and I wanted to get your take on it. I purposely didn't read your Tribune review. If you don't know, he's been playing all of Dark Side of the Moon. That was the second set. But the first set was kind of a sampling from throughout his career.
Mm-hmm.
And what he did is pull together, I believe, every anti-war song he's ever written. And it made two points. He made it very clearly about America's involvement in Iraq, but also it said, hey, Pink Floyd is always dismissed as this band that sounds good, that has no ideas, but here is this work that has always meant something. I've always been anti-war. And if you listen, even in The Dark Side of the Moon, Us and Them is a song about war. And money, he put in the context with those wonderful videos of the pumping oil rigs, you mm-hmm. know, that kind of said, hey, this is what it's all about. I thought it was an interesting take from an old geezer, classic rock dude.
This whole Waters-Gilmour split, we've seen Gilmour on the road in the spring. Now Waters, you know, it's odd. Here are these guys reunited for four songs at the Live 8 concert in London in 2005, and it was brilliant. You go,
it was great.
These four guys belong together. So Gilmour goes on the road, and he's got Rick Wright with him on keyboards. Waters goes on the road, and he's got Nick Mason with him on drums on a few tour stops.
Yeah, he played all the European shows, but only a handful in America.
So these four guys are sort of floating around, circling each other, going, you know, let's do the obvious thing, and let's get together and do this right, guys, huh?
Well, it's high time, because as Waters sings in the Flesh, anything else is just a surrogate band.
It's ridiculous, and it was a surrogate band. It was Waters doing very note-perfect cover versions of all of his best-known music, and the band was certainly up to speed in terms of its ability to replicate all those classic parts. But it's interesting, the solos aren't solos anymore. They are note for note mimicry of David Gilmour's guitar parts.
So you might as well get Gilmour in.
You might as well get Gilmour. He's out there, he's touring, and Gilmour says he doesn't want to do it, and Waters is kind of being a little, you know, cagey about it. I gotta say, Jim, I completely disagree with you on the political end of it.
Do you really?
My God, I felt like I was getting my head caved in by a sledgehammer. I mean, I agree with 98% of what he was saying. I mean, we're in a bad war and we're being run by a president who I disagree with. I don't need to have that pounded into my head. It's kind of a dim-witted sense of preaching with dull music behind it. Everything from the final cut onward has been kind of increasingly dull. And the Nadir was this new song that he's showcasing on this tour called Leaving Beirut.
It's
a dull, lifeless, amelodic song with really kind of transparent political ideas. Man, does he think that little of me that I can't even understand a song with a little bit of complexity in it? I mean, does he have to batter me over the head with his ideas?
You're being unkind. See, you're letting the Who off easy last week, giving them a completely free
pass.
They
didn't come at me with a bunch of dim-witted political ideas. They came at me with music that had a lot of passion and it was about spiritual quest.
I didn't hear that in Waters'
music.
He feels strongly about this song. He released it on his own, recorded it quickly, put it out there. It's called Leaving Beirut.
Are these the people that we should bomb? Are we so sure they mean us harm? Is this our pleasure, punishment or crime? Is this a mountain that we really want to climb? The road is hard, hard and long. Put down that 2x4, this man will turn you from his door.
Leaving Beirut, new music from Roger Waters that he's showcasing on his current tour. Jim and I are going to have to agree to disagree on that one.
We agree on one thing.
Can't think of how dull that music is.
No, we agree on one thing, is that he needs Gilmour and Gilmour needs him.
Absolutely.
So boys, you know, bury the hatchet.
You're listening to Sound Opinions from Chicago Public Radio and American Public Media. Next up, a dissection of a classic album from the 1970s, Stevie Wonder's Songs in the Key of Life. Number one album, of course, as was just about every album Stevie Wonder released in the 70s. In addition to that, his best-selling album of all time, more than 10 million sold. In a lot of ways, Jim, I think the signature album of his career. When people think Stevie Wonder, what's he done? He's had a ton of hits, but I think this is the first album people think of when they think of Stevie Wonder, Songs in the Key of Life. We're going to look at it in greater detail, find out what made it tick.
Well, the music tells a story, Greg, and that's the place to start. Here is a brief montage that our producer Matt Fingerspiegel put together of some of the songs from Songs in the Key of Life. We'll be playing more later, but this will give you a sense of what makes this album special.
That was just a sampling of some of the 21 songs that Stevie Wonder stuffed onto Songs in the Key of Life when he was making that album over 2 years. The album finally came out in 1976, 30 years ago. That music still holds up. When you hear that opening horn fanfare for Sir Duke, it still blows people's minds. Jim, I know from personal experience, having played that particular song for some eighth grade classes that I go speak to over the years, their heads perk up when they hear that song. They go, what was that? Where can I get that? It's suddenly like this revelation that this guy Stevie Wonder made this amazing music 30 years ago. And here we are looking back on it. It's important to recognize when this album was made. The mid-70s, Stevie Wonder at that point was already the biggest pop artist in the land. He was coming off a 4-album run that I still think is one of the best 4 and soon to be 5-album runs in music history. From 1972 to 1974, he made Music of My Mind, Talking Book, Inner Visions, Fulfillingness's First Finale, all of them, Jim, masterpieces as far as I'm concerned. Then
it's considered his classic period.
Oh, my God. He was making amazing work. Coming off of Marvin Gaye's What's Going On, which was kind of the emancipation address for artists at Motown. Before they'd sort of been locked into this production line at Motown and Berry Gordy, the songwriters wrote the songs, the performers performed the songs, the house band was the band on every song. Marvin Gaye sort of freed himself from those strictures on What's Going On and sort of cleared the way for Stevie Wonder to be his own boss in the studio, make the records the way he wanted to, write the songs the way he wanted to, produce the songs the way he wanted to, play, in many cases, the songs entirely himself, become a one-man band in the studio. He was on a remarkable roll. And then in 1975, he decides to clear the decks again. Mm-hmm. He'd been working with these two guys, Robert Magouloff and Malcolm Cecil, and just said, okay, I'm parting ways with you guys. I'm moving on. He ditched his band, started hiring some new people. You're going to hear from one of them in the next few minutes. These young guys, some of whom had not really had a lot of experience in other recording sessions of any magnitude, bring them into his new team and recording what would be the landmark album of his career, Songs in the Key of Life.
Yeah, I have to confess, when we were talking, Greg, about what we were going to do for our second classic album dissection, I was dubious when you suggested Stevie Wonder's Songs in the Key of Life. We had done Revolver for our first of these on public radio on the occasion of its 40th anniversary, the Beatles classic. You know, I was skeptical. I respect Stevie Wonder more than I really deeply admire him, and especially Songs in the Key of Life. I mean, call me weird and perverse, but after Songs in the Key of Life, Wonder's classic period ended, and he started making albums like Secret Lives of Plants, you know, where it was basically new age Muzak with a lot of synthesizer. I kind of prefer that because I'm a Moog freak. Yeah. I love what Wonder did with the synthesizer. You know, Songs in the Key of Life has some classic singles. We heard some of them in the montage. We're going to play more of them later. But it also has some sappiness. You know, something like Isn't She Lovely. You dig into the history of the album, you realize he's talking about his baby girl, Aisha, who had just recently been born. And obviously there's one or two lyrical nods. Suddenly it gives you a whole new perspective. But Stevie, he's not a very good lyricist. And I went back and I dug up the original 1976 Rolling Stone record review. Vince Aletti, who I think is one of the most insightful writers ever, he really gave a lukewarm review to Songs in the Key of Life in December 76 in Rolling Stone because the lyrics were so dumb. I quote, Wonder's lyrics aren't clever or particularly intelligent, but at their best, they're instinctive, straightforward, and touchingly sincere. Unfortunately, at their worst, they're convoluted, awkward, atrociously rhymed, and tangled up in their pretensions to poetic style. Of course, you can argue, it's never been about the lyrics with Stevie. It's about that voice, which is one of the most expressive in all of rock or pop history, and also about his arranging talents. I went in and read the history of where this album was coming from. One thing that really helped me understand the album is that Wonder had had a serious, almost fatal automobile accident in August of 73, so almost 3 years before the release of this album. He was driving in a car. He wasn't driving because he's blind, but he was in the passenger seat, and a truck in front of them, a log came rolling off it, went right through the windshield, smashed into his head, put him in a coma for some time, and resulted in a permanent loss of his sense of smell. So here you have this incredible man who is deprived of his sight, no longer has his smell, which of course affects his taste. The only sense that Stevie Wonder really has left is touching and hearing, you know. And he makes this incredible album called Songs in the Key of Life. It says right in the title, I'm happy to be alive. This guy is just glad that he survived these things. He's looking at the things around him that are good, the loves of his life, for his daughter, for his significant other, and music. It's hard to be cynical about it. The slightness of some of the lyrics, the cheery optimism, when this guy is just lucky to be alive at all.
Absolutely, I think that's the beauty of this record. Notice the chord structures. It's almost all major chords. He simplified his music in a lot of ways. A lot of people lamented, and I think Vince Aletti was among them, who lamented the fact that in a lot of ways this is a less complex album than those earlier masterworks that I cited. You know, there was protest songs on those earlier records. There were darker melodies. There's nothing like that on Songs in the Key of Life. It's all up. It's all kind of major keys, and there's beautiful melodies throughout this record, and I think you nailed it on the head, Jim. This is a joyous record, and coming where it did in the middle of the 70s, on the cusp of punk, we were, you know, at the end of the Nixon administration, the country was in a really low state of mind at that point. It was an amazing document to come out when it did and saying what it did. Kind of a reaffirmation of why we're on this planet. And, you know, in a lot of ways, these songs address everything from childhood and I Wish to childbirth and Isn't She Lovely to love in a song like Knocks Me Off My Feet to his just sheer joy at being a fan in Sir Duke. I mean, just the joy loving of that music, as you're saying.
Well, and it took forever to make. That's part of the story. You know, 2 years in the making this album, hundreds of songs to choose from, recorded on both coasts, a massive effort. We're going to get some insight into all of that. But first, we have to take a short break. When we return, we're going to talk to one of the musicians who worked on the session, as well as one of the engineers. Then you'll hear Greg and my favorite tracks from Songs in the Key of Life by Stevie Wonder. That's when we return to Sound Opinions from Chicago Public Radio and American Public Media.
Ship on the first Columbus trip was a brown
Welcome back to Sound Opinions from Chicago Public Radio and American Public Media. We're in the midst of dissecting Stevie Wonder's classic album Songs in the Key of Life. But before we give you more of our take on the record, we wanted to talk to some of the people involved in the making of it.
Greg Fillinganes was the man hired to play keyboards on the album, including Fender Rhodes, the electric acoustic piano that Fender, the guitar people, made. Though, of course, Stevie himself is a keyboardist. Fillinganes has since played with countless musicians, including Michael Jackson, Paul McCartney, and Quincy Jones, but Songs in the Key of Life was his first job. We asked him about this experience.
So you were how old when Stevie hired you?
Just before I turned 19. But here's the other side of that perspective. It was just before I turned 19, but it was just before he turned 26.
Right. Mm.
I mean 25, rather. He was a baby, too. It was like he wasn't even 25 yet.
He'd had a substantial career already at that point,
though. Oh, unbelievable. He was the king.
He was on a roll at that point. I mean, those four albums that he'd made right in a row there, Music of My
Absolutely.
Mind, Talking Book, Inner Visions, Fulfilling as His First Finale,
from
72 to 74. And now, did you sort of have a sense of what was going on, that he was making this massive, you know, this is going to be the biggest project yet?
No, I had a sense that it was going to be really big because it's taken so darn long.
Yeah.
How long were the sessions?
Oh. There are sessions and then there's Stevie time. You know what I'm saying? I mean, it's like we didn't have like formal sessions. It's just like you went to the studio and that's where you were.
Did he have a grand plan? I guess that was the question that Greg Kot was asking before. We're talking to Greg Fillinganes, who played on Songs in the Key of Life. Did Stevie have a grand concept, a grand plan, or was it a creative thing that was just it was developing as you guys went along during these endless recording sessions?
Well, if anything, it was more of the latter, you know, mm-hmm. that things developed more because he was he gathered inspiration from a lot of different areas, the band being one of the main parts, I would say, but he had a ton of songs as well.
Mm-hmm. He is notable for being able to play just about anything he wants, any instrument he wants, more than competently, and has made some tracks completely on his own. Mm-hmm. What was your sense of what, you know, and it must have been daunting for you, especially, Greg, as a keyboard player, you know, here's maybe the premier keyboardist on the planet at that point, and certainly the most celebrated, asking you to do keyboard parts on his record. What kind of direction was he giving you guys?
Well, he was pretty specific. What I loved about learning from him was that he had or has this tremendous ability to understand the essence of any genre and translate that back in his own way, but make it believable at the same time. And, you know, he probably got that from Ray, because Ray, I think, was the same way.
From Ray Charles.
But, yeah. You know, I adapted that mentality from him. At the same time, he knew that I understood him, that I understood him musically. I understood how he thinks. You know, I wasn't able to do everything he could do at that time. But, you know, I think he trusted me more than I trusted myself at the time because, yeah, I was pretty nervous. It was it was an incredible thing. You know, I mean, I remember, for instance, when we were working on the song Saturn, he was using at this time this prototype, really, of an instrument from Yamaha called the Dream Machine. It's this huge white thing, and it could house a family of eight. I mean, it was huge. And the two of us are sitting on this grandiose thing, and we're playing these parts, and it's just me and him, and he's just sitting there bobbing his head, and I started bobbing my head, too. It was just like the two of us, and it was really very intimate and very special.
Through the ages, all great men have taught truth and happiness just can't be bought or sold. Tell me, why are you people so cold? Going back to Saturn where the rings all
And you guys were both sitting on this huge instrument.
Yeah.
Wow, that's pretty amazing. What was to say that he wouldn't just do it himself and overdub all this stuff? Why did he want another musician involved here?
I guess to give you know, someone like me the experience.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you got to remember, he's already worked on like 95% of it.
Right.
You know, the album is such an explosion of optimism, or big parts of it are. Do you think that he also wanted, you know, jaded at the age of 26, he hadn't done all this stuff. Did he want the perspective of a 19-year-old kid for whom this is like the greatest thing in the universe, and you're there and you're fresh? And so even though he could have played your parts, there might have been a vibe coming through in the way that you played them?
Oh, I would imagine so. It was certainly gracious on his part. But it was also a way of getting me acclimated to the whole recording process.
Talk about Isn't She Lovely, Greg. You played on that track as well, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where did you fit in there in terms of what he envisioned for it?
I did the Rhodes part. I mean, something he could have easily done, but he wanted me to do it. He did the drums and the synthesizer bass and string parts, the orchestrations, all that stuff on mm-hmm. the synthesizer. But he had me do the Rhodes.
Well, obviously he had parts in mind. What was it about Stevie's parts? I mean, you've played with so many musicians, Greg. Is there a distinguishing feature that Stevie had in the way he wrote keyboard parts?
Absolutely. Well, you know, his whole approach is basically unorthodox, you know, but he draws from a lot of sources as far as different genres of music. And so he's able to weave them in a very unique way, and that spells out his musical DNA, you know. But the part to Isn't She Lovely is just the chords. I mean, you know, that's pretty straight ahead.
A lot of people talk about this as kind of being his grand pop record. Everything was kind of major chord based, and there was a lot of really catchy choruses. How do you sort of view this record against his other work during that period when Stevie could do no wrong, basically?
Well, this was the culmination, really, of everything that he had built prior to this. I've often said that it's the, and I don't mean this in a bad way, but it's the last great Stevie album. It's the last great complete Stevie album.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the album since then, he's had great moments, but this was the last complete where everything was just unbelievable. Every cut was a gem, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Let me ask you just one more question to wrap up, Greg. Do you have a particular favorite on the record, one that you may or may not have played on?
It's not a favorite. It's one of my favorites, and I did happen to play on it. It's Joy Inside My Tears. You know, that song just absolutely tears me up. So deep and heavy and passionate, you know.
I've always come to the conclusion that blood is the way of asking for permission to lay something heavy on one's head. I feel that lasting moments are coming. So I should tell you of the happiness that you
Greg, thanks for taking time out to do this. It was a pleasure.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for asking.
You made life his glory. Oh, baby. You brought joy inside my tears.
As we mentioned before, Songs in the Key of Life was not unique just for its sound, but for how it was recorded and how it was released. Motown gave Stevie Wonder the freedom to record in the studio for 2 years, and the resulting songs were released as two LPs back in the days when there was vinyl, kids, plus an EP that was included as a bonus. We wanted to ask one of the album's two recording engineers, John Fischbach, about what it was like to be in the studio with Stevie Wonder.
What was it about Stevie's working methods that struck you? I mean, you've worked with countless artists. Stevie must have been in a category of his own in terms of just how he approached everything.
Number one, he is the consummate professional in the studio. There is nobody better in a studio than him. He knows exactly what he wants. He knows what he wants it pretty much to sound like. Though we were given incredible latitude to change sounds. If I didn't like a drum sound, we would go buy a different set of drums. If we hated a recording, we were always given the option to redo it. So he was the best in the studio.
I heard a story about, I think it was I Wish, the Sir Duke tribute, where he was, I guess he sent the band home at one point and then called him back like an hour or two later and said, I've got this great song I want you guys to play on, and got everybody out of bed to come back to the recording session.
That's Steve. that is him. I mean, I think those years he was unbelievably prolific. I think we had over 200 songs in the can.
Wow.
When Songs in the Key of Life came out. We had always had a two-track ready to go. A whole song would just come all at once. He'd sit down at the piano and boom, out would come this whole song.
We're talking to John Fishbeck, who was the engineer throughout the Songs in the Key of Life sessions, and I mean sessions that dragged on for for almost 2 years, I guess. Why did Stevie need other musicians on this record? It was clear that he could have played everything himself and sang everything himself if he'd wanted to.
I think there were certain things that he knew could be done better by somebody else, like Snuffy Walden was actually the third guitarist that we used on a song, because the first two guitarists that were used were incredible guitarists, but they didn't bring whatever it was that Snuffy brought. And whatever he heard in Snuffy was right, whereas what the other two were doing, according to Steve, was wrong.
Why would he, for example, though, need a Greg Fillinganes as another keyboardist? I mean, it seems to me that Stevie could do anything he wants on a keyboard.
That's really kind of true. But the fact of the matter is, I don't know if Greg told you that we used to call him Memorex. And because Greg was totally sympathetic to Steve's style of play. So it fit in really, really well. Plus, when Greg came to us, I think he was only 18 years old.
Yeah, mm-hmm. He was just about to turn 19.
So, he was just real malleable. He did what Stevie wanted him to do. It was a different texture.
You have to wonder, too, if Stevie wanted that element of the person who was completely fresh to this.
Absolutely, and it was all part of something that was really new. Plus, the idea of having Wonder Love was something that Steve was really interested in. He really wanted to have a band, a real band. And I think if you listen to Contusion, there's a good example of that was a great band.
Mm-hmm. That was almost like a jazz rock thing that he was doing there.
Yeah, it was fantastic.
John, it's been great talking to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Greg, when we do these classic album dissections, we like to have the last word ourselves. And we do that by playing a song from the album that we particularly love. There are so many, as you said, 21 total on two vinyl albums, if you remember those kids, plus a vinyl EP. A lot to choose from, and you could go in so many different directions. As I said, I'm being the cynical punk rock type. I kind of scoff at some of the more optimistic moments, although now that I'm a father myself, Isn't She Lovely means more to me. You made a statement before that you didn't think there were any of those edgy protest songs or those, you know, city in turmoil tunes like Superstition or Living for the City that had come earlier in Wonder's classic period, and I beg to differ, and I'm going to play one of those. Pastime Paradise, I think, is a very sneaky protest song or bemoaning song, one of the saddest moments on an otherwise incredibly unrelentingly upbeat album, and I think it's one of Wonder's best tunes ever. I hear this as him looking at people who are walking through life in a daze, not appreciating the good things, which is how it fits in with the rest of Songs in the Key of Life, but also not taking action against the bad things. It's sort of a bridge after he sets up the song, and it has this kind of creepy vibe where he starts to list in a really interesting way all the problems around him. Dissipation, race relations, consolation, segregation, dispensation, isolation, exploitation, mutilation, mutations, miscreation, confirmation to the evils of the world. That's how he ends that list. He's not celebrating these things. He could be seen as complaining about them. I think ultimately what he's doing is telling people to take action against them. Lift yourself up and out and move against these things, because the next time he does that list, it's done very differently. Acclamation, world salvation, vibrations, stimulation. Get off your butt and do something. That's what I hear Stevie Wonder saying. And kids, if we're introducing you to Songs in the Key of Life, and you hear this song as I play it, and it sounds really familiar, let me tell you why. The key sample for Coolio's huge hit, Gangster's Paradise, in the 90s, one of the biggest hip-hop hits of the 90s, is based on this song. That's where the sample came from. Here's the original and the best, Pastime Paradise by Stevie Wonder.
They've been spending most of their lives living in a pastime paradise. Been spending most of their lives living in a pastime paradise. Been wasting most of their time glorifying days long gone behind. Been wasting most of their days in remembrance of ignorance so disgraced. Tell me who of them will come. Consolation, segregation, dispensation, isolation, exploitation, mutilation, mutation, miscreation, confirmation to the evils of the world. And spending most of their lives living in a future paradise, they keep telling of the day when the Savior of love will come to stay. Tell me who of them will come to be. How many of them are you and me? Proclamation, grace relations, consolation, integration, verification of revelation, acclamation, world salvation, vibration, stimulation, confirmation to peace of the world. They've been spending most of their lives living in the pastime paradise.
Pastime Paradise, you're right, Jim, one of the classics from Songs in the Key of Life. Even that one, he manages to turn optimistic, though. I think
absolutely.
The mood of this album is very up, and that... You know, the way he uses the Afro-Caribbean percussion and those synth strings in there, very evoking another song. I think Eleanor Rigby from the Beatles, the way he arranges those. The song I'm going to go for is the song As. Here is Stevie in jazz mode. He basically tours the stylistic universe on this record. He plays everything, Afro-Caribbean music,
soul, funk,
yeah. Rock. I mean, he's touching on it all. Gospel. There are elements of jazz and gospel, especially in the song, and I love it for the way it came together. And you can hear very much the vibe in the room when you listen to this track. Stevie could basically, as Greg Fillingane said, could play basically everything himself. But he didn't want to on this record. He wanted to have those musicians in the room with him so that he could fire off them in a live setting. And As was very much recorded live. You can hear the essence of this impromptu band he put together. Herbie Hancock didn't play a whole lot of stuff on this record, but on this track he is all over it on that Rhodes keyboard. And his Rhodes and Stevie's voice are really the linchpin of this song, the interaction between those two instruments. Meanwhile, you've got this incredible bass line played by one Nathan Watts, who I think is the unsung hero of this record. He is the guy who sort of is the glue on 75% of this record. You can also hear this guitarist, Dean Parks, and there's a drummer by the name of Greg Brown, and they're basically firing off Stevie and this wonderful, optimistic lyric about love. I mean, love that is going to last and transcend time. It sounds like a hokey sentiment on paper, but the way Stevie sings it makes you believe. The key moment for me in this track is that Herbie Hancock solo in the middle of the song where he does something really incredible with his right hand. There's like a tremolo part in it, and you'll hear it in the middle of the solo where he really kind of dirties up, grimes it up a little bit. And all of a sudden, Stevie's voice goes from this very smooth vocal approach to this kind of gritty gospel feel. And then he overdubs a whole bunch of Stevies in the background to give it this really happening gospel feel. So this,
wall
you can
of Stevies.
Sort of see. Yeah, it's a beautiful thing. I think one of the quintessential tracks in his career, and certainly one of the centerpieces of Songs in the Key of Life. It's Az on Sound Opinions.
As the day I know I'm living but tomorrow could make me the past, but that I mustn't fear. For I'll know deep in my mind the love of me I've left behind, 'cause I'll be loving you
When we come back on Sound Opinions from Chicago Public Radio and American Public Media, we will be reviewing the new albums from Beck and the Killers.
back to Sound Opinions from Chicago Public Radio and American Public Media. I'm Jim DeRogatis. My partner is Greg Kot, and that is Beck, a song called Nausea, which is the first single from his new album, The Information, follow-up to last year's Guero. Who is Beck? Well, Beck Hansen is this L.A. sonic alchemist and perverse little imp who dates back to the alternative era, the beginning of the 90s, when he first made his big splash with Loser. I'm a loser, baby. We all remember it. And proceeded to ride through the 90s as many critics' favorite genre-hopping guy who was mixing hip-hop and funk and soul and rock, old alternative sounds, and I mean, everything, and the kitchen sink. It's what Beck is famous for. You know, where has Beck been? In 2002, he made a very introspective and quiet album called Sea Change, which was really, I think, the best of his folky albums. He's made those in between the more soulful stuff. And then came back last year with Guero. It seems to, I think, he's been having a little bit of a midlife crisis. You know, Sea Change was all about the end of this romantic relationship. It left him devastated. Now he's married. Actress Marissa Ribisi of Dazed and Confused. He has a 2-year-old son. And he picked up this album, The Information, which he'd left off while making Guero. Started working on this record with Nigel Godrich. Godrich had worked on Sea Change and Mutations with him, as well as being the guy behind Radiohead's OK Computer and Kid A. But then he got busy working with Tom York, and Beck got distracted working on Guero, only recently came back to this mass of songs, 15 tunes on this album, as well as 15 videos. Made these homemade, low-budget videos in the studio while working on the album. Bought an eBay mixer for $100 and edited these videos. Videos are no great shakes, but there's a lot on this album, The Information. You get 15 songs, you get 15 videos. Let's hear a track. It's called Think I'm in Love, and then we'll get into our opinions on this new Beck album, The Information.
I better get a hold of myself. Don't wanna let the night get ahead of myself. Whispering hello through a smoke-winged smile. She doesn't know what happens when she's around. I think I'm in love, but it makes you kind of nervous to say so.
I'm in love from the new Beck album, The Information. Jim, as you mentioned, this guy has been the king of willy-nilly, hodgepodge, melting pot music for the last decade plus. In a lot of ways, I think he was one of the symbolic artists of the 90s, where this kind of approach to music making really came into vogue. On the last record, he started to sound like he was repeating himself. The Guero record was definitely Beck covering Beck, and I think it was a misstep, the first serious misstep in his career. With The Information, the most alluring thing about it is, you know, your ears are hit by this record, and you go, wow, he's in a different place again. He's experimenting with sound in really inventive ways. Drums don't sound like drums anymore. There's all sorts of percussion devices on this record. It's beautiful ear candy. There's some cool bass lines in here. There's a lot of sort of funk-based bass lines on this record. And for the first 5 or 6 tracks, I'm thinking there's some really cool songs here. But I think he loses the plot about halfway through.
Mm-hmm.
These blobs of sound start becoming just blobs of sound. And I think what's lacking here are those hooks that made Odelay such a alluring mid-90s, you know, signpost. There's a point in this record where there's song after song, beginning with about New Round, Into Dark Star, into We Dance Alone, where I feel like, you know, I just would have dropped those tracks altogether. This record could have been much tighter, much better, if he had stuck to the more song-oriented stuff. I think he's got about maybe 8 pretty cool songs on here, but as it is, it's about 15 tracks long. And as a result, I have to say this is kind of a misfire, although I do like the fact that he's experimenting again. I just wish there were better songs to go with
it. Well, look, this is a common problem in the age of CD. Just because I can fill a CD with 15 songs plus 15 videos, you know, doesn't mean that you should, Mr. Artist. But, Greg, I don't know if he's ever been better than he is on the good moments here. And the reason I feel that way is while Guero was sort of Beck by numbers, Beck imitating Beck, and Sea Change was this blast of sincerity from an artist who is known for his surrealism, I think that he combines those two approaches here, goes back to the old hip-hop-driven, groove-oriented approach on some songs, gives us more honesty and directness and straightforward pop songwriting than he has on pretty much anywhere else except for Sea Change. And you wouldn't think that those two strains could go together, but they do. Plus, he's getting serious and political in some of these tunes. Dark Star, that song that you would cut off, when he's singing a widow's tears washing a soldier's bones, sterilized ego, delirium sequels punctured by the arrows of American Eagles. I mean, I don't turn to Beck for great revelation, but I think that there's meaning there, as there is in Think I'm in Love. Not since he told us he had two turntables and a microphone did he give us a line as good as in this new song, Cell Phone's Dead, when he says, make a kick drum sound like an SOS. I think he's having fun, but he's also being serious. I think this is a great album, and I would recommend on the Sound Opinions Buy It, Burn It, Trash It rating scale that people buy this. For sure, there's some filler, but there's 15 tracks. You can program out the ones you don't like.
Yeah, that's what you're going to have to do, unfortunately. And just like the album cover, assemble your own album cover, take those little pasty things that he's included on the record and create your own record cover with them. I think you're going to have to create your own best album out of this one, because the one he's giving us right now is not Beck at his best. I'd say it's a Burn It. When You Were Young, the first single from The Killers' new album, their second album, it's called Sam's Town. And this band is coming off a 5 million selling debut record in 2004 called Hot Fuss. Big hits like Somebody Told Me, Mr. Brightside. Part of that new wave of new wave sound that was all the rage in rock 2 or 3 years ago. In other words, reviving that late 70s, early 80s sound that you knew from bands like, oh, anyone from Gang of Four to Haircut 100. The beauty of Hot Fuss was here was a band that was not taking itself too seriously, writing these kind of grandiose melodies that swept radio and swept these guys out of Vegas into the very top of the rock echelon. Now, Sam's Town, the new album, they have upped the ante considerably on this one, Jim. They kind of worked with a nobody producer on their first record, and he did a fine job, obviously. He got 5 million sales out of a guy by the name of Jeff Salzman. Now they bring in the heavy artillery.
Oh, yeah.
They are bringing in Flood, and they're bringing in Alan Moulder, two British producers whose collective resume, I mean, listen to this. These guys collectively worked with Nine Inch Nails, My Bloody Valentine, U2, Depeche Mode, The Smashing Pumpkins. I mean, it goes on and on and on. Mulder and Flood are the real deal when it comes to making hit records. Apparently, that's what The Killers were going for on this new record. We're going to discuss it in a second, but first, let's play one of the tracks. It's important to note, too, that this record kind of edges a little bit towards the darker side of Vegas, whereas the first record was more about the glitz and the glam. Sam's Town is a reference to a out-of-the-way casino, away from the strip, away from the glamour of the strip, and kind of where the blue-collar element in Vegas hangs out. There is a blue-collar element. Apparently the tourists don't see that, but this is the side of Vegas that the Killers are supposedly writing about in this new album called Sam's Town. Let's hear a track from this new album by the Killers. It's called Uncle Johnny on Sound Opinions.
He's convinced himself from
That's Uncle Johnny, a song from The Killers' second album, Sam's Town, coming off their 5 million selling 2004 album, Hot Fuss. I don't think it's an exaggeration, Greg, say this is one of the most anticipated albums of the fall. I despise this album with a hatred that I rarely have felt for pretty much anyone or anything. You know, it is one thing to shamelessly rip off The Cure and The Smiths and Duran Duran, as you said. It is quite another thing to then turn to the most bombastic, silly, muscle and synthesizer-bound album of the 80s from the most unexpected source, Bruce Springsteen's Born in the USA. These guys are making a big deal from the title of the album, Sam's Town, a title of a song, The River is Wild. Yep. These guys are imitating Springsteen at his very, very worst. How could you possibly mix the over-singing of The Boss with the over-singing of Robert Smith? Yep. Well, Brandon Flowers does it. He's the keyboardist and vocalist. At the same time, he's delivering the most horribly cheesy synthesizer sounds you've heard since Haircut 100. And he's given us some of the stupidest lyrics. We heard When You Were Young on the way in. The devil's water, it ain't so sweet. You don't have to drink right now, but you can dip your feet. It's like, this guy is a putz, man. Just because some stuff was big in the 80s does not mean it should come back. I don't want Margaret Thatcher back. I don't want Ronald Reagan. And I sure don't want The Killers. Yeah, this is a trash it record.
Oh, it's well, you know what? You've done the job for me. I don't really have anything more to add to that other than the fact that I never want to hear this album again. You're absolutely right. This guy's...
People think we have an easy job. We had to listen to this half a dozen times to formulate an opinion.
I have to say that Hot Fuss was kind of a guilty pleasure for me. I enjoyed a good half of that record just for the pure Duran Duran buzz I got off of it. You know, not that I thought Duran Duran was any great shakes either, but they had some great radio singles, and ditto for Hot Fuss and The Killers. I thought Somebody Told Me is a song that I never got tired of listening to. It seemed kind of fun. It seemed kind of glammy. He wasn't taking himself too seriously. I love that about that guy. What happened to that guy?
He listened to Springsteen.
He's writing lines like, we're burning down the highway skyline on the back of a hurricane. They have completely lost the plot. Everything that was good about this band has been just obliterated. And I really got to blame Flood and Alan Moulder, two guys with incredible taste. Couldn't they have alerted this guy? Hey, you're playing away from your strengths. You're making this kind of dumb, big stadium rock album when, in fact, you guys are this kind of cool, glammy, glitzy new wave band. That's
I don't
what
think
you
it works that
with.
Way. I don't think Bono listens to them either.
So on our patented Sound Opinions rating scale, buy it, burn it, trash it. There is no doubt, Jim, this is one of those trash it, burn the trash can, destroy the room that the trash can is in albums.
You know, there are certain times, and it's rare, but certain times when trash it doesn't seem low enough.
Low enough, yeah. Jim, we're bound to have some albums that we like a lot better than The Killers record. We are going to be reviewing a boatload of new releases. It's that time of year. The major labels are rushing to the Christmas deadline to release all their big records. We've got some big ones for next week, including the new records from Janet Jackson, The Hold Steady, The Scissor Sisters, who are the biggest band in England these days, and The Decemberists, who is Colin Molloy, was on Sound Opinions just a few months ago, now returning with his full-blown theatrical band project.
We have some thank yous to say on the way out this week. Tori Southside Malatia is our executive producer. Todd Bachman is our managing producer and director. Matt Fingerspiegel is our producer and our medleyologist. Jason Saldana and Robin Lynn are our associate producers. We get legal help from Dino Armiros, technical assistance from Joe Dassault, and no end of goodwill from Jim Russell over at American Public Media.
Thank you for listening.